9 years ago to the day, Reading FC won promotion with a Michaeli Ledgerwood strike past Nottingham Forest. And just as we remember that moment, it appears certain that we will go a clean decade before we get that lovely feeling again. Welcome to the Tyler Sten podcast, episode 261 with your host, Mark Mao. And well, it's one of those episodes, I'm afraid. And with me to discuss one of those weekends is Dave Handbags Harris. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm all right. Saturday after the Friday night before.
Yeah.
I'm upright and breathing, put it that way.
It certainly fits that Saturday morning after the Friday night before narrative, doesn't it? Even if you didn't have anything to drink last night, it's probably one of those days, because Reading 1, Cardiff 1 is how it finished. At the Medeski, it was billed beforehand as a game that, you know, really we had to win. It's not quite how it turned out. And, you know, the performance as well, we'll get into in just a bit. But we'll start the recap in just a second with a bit of a trip down memory lane for that Nottingham Forest promotion winning game that was 9 years ago to the day as we record. Before we do that, big thanks, as always, to our sponsor, ZCZ Films, and our Patreon subscribers. And, well, we're into the home stretch now, so let's go into the recap and talk about how Reading are faring.
Come rain or shine, it's time to relive the latest match action with the recap.
This podcast is sponsored by ZCZ Films, Reading's oldest ultras.
So, Handbags, let me start this discussion, as I say, with a bit of a lovely trip down memory lane for better times, and not too far off where we are now, but certainly I was watching a couple of days ago when it was 9 years ago to the day of the Southampton win at St Mary's, which is always one of my all-time favourite away days, that was. And then a few days after that, I think it's the Tuesday night, we had Nottingham Forest at home, bit of a tight, nervy affair. That tension completely unleashed with, I think, 86th minute or so, Michaeli Ledgerwood hooked his foot round a free kick ball into the box. And the rest, as they say, is history. And I wanted to ask, first question really, is how, if you know, 20,000 people ran onto the pitch that day, what number do you think you were to get onto the pitch?
I was at the top of Y25, I certainly wasn't anywhere near the first, but around sort of 10,000-ish, I would imagine. You kind of just pile my way to the front as towards the dressing room entrance, and just sort of gazing up at Sir John and dare I mention it, Anton Zingarevich and the players, everyone up there. I wasn't one of the first, but mainly because of where I was in the stadium. It was good times.
It was, and I think, I mean, I'd give myself credit and say I was maybe the 1,500th person or so. I was at the back of Y19, and I remember that for the QPR game in 05-06, when, I think, was it QPR? I can't remember what exact, it might have been the Derby game, actually, when the pitch invasion was. When we won the title. And for that one, I was a bit younger. I couldn't, you know, it wouldn't really be a good idea to let someone that age just run out on the pitch on their own. So I was with my dad, you know, took it a bit easier and everything like that. But with this one, I think I was about 18 for this game. So I was like, you know, I'm gonna get down there. I certainly wasn't, you know, front row, but I was definitely like, yeah, I'm ready for this. I'm going to do it. And for me, it was just that sort of, it just came at the perfect time of all of the, you know, the surprise of it as much as anything. And as I say, the relief with the goal going in and just the sheer ecstasy of the moment. And I think it's such a unique feeling that you have to sort of, you know, revel in it when it does come round.
Yeah, absolutely you do. That Derby game, if I remember rightly, the club hadn't really kind of prepared for a pitch invasion. So initially they were trying to prevent people going on onto the pitch, but then they just let everybody spill on. And again, top of Y25, my brother and I, we stayed up there until it was clear that they were just letting people on. But the Forest game, they'd anticipated and expected it, and of course it was just a wave of people sprinting onto the pitch and just in just sheer delight. You've got to go through the bad times to appreciate those good times. that was clearly one of the good times. But little did we know, just put a little bit of a downer on it. Little bit did we know that it was the start of some fairly significant financial issues that have plagued us ever since. But you live in the moment, don't you? And yeah, it was great times, really, really enjoyable times. But yeah, tension, big time. But the good thing was that, of course, when the 8 o'clock, it was the 8 o'clock start came into its own, really, for us, because West Ham were at Bristol City and had started 15 minutes earlier and had drawn 1-1. Hence, we knew what we needed to do, got what we needed. And then it was, if I remember rightly, it was only a goal line clearance from Alex Pearce in something like the 93rd minute that preserved the win that we needed to go up. Yeah, we did enough. Did enough against an improving Forest team. Then they think they changed managers halfway through, and Steve Cottrell was their manager, and they played well that night, I thought.
It's funny, isn't it? I remember also might have been the game after that we played Crystal Palace at home and drew 2-2, and that was again meant to be a win, and we've won the title, and we managed to not win that game because that was an improving Crystal Palace team, as it certainly turned out to be. Funny enough, you mentioned the finances. We will talk about the financial stuff that's come out about Reading later in the show. But one of my memories, because I saw this photo on my Facebook earlier today, and it was one of my mates, Sean, who's in the Upper West with his dad and everything like that for that game. And the most Upper West way of doing a pitch invasion was they moved into the executive box with the red seats and watched it all unfold from there, which I think is definitely the most Upper West way of celebrating. that's the rebellious nature of that. So yeah, if anyone wants to send in their memories of that game, obviously, it's to today, so maybe it's as you're watching this, maybe the anniversary has passed, but we'll be hopefully looking down a bit more of that as the weeks to come, because really, in terms of what we've got to look at this season, it appears to be somewhat dwindling, as we've kind of feared for a while now. For the Cardiff game, I'd start by saying that John Swift was back on the bench, Omar Richards and Lucas Shaw into the team. Pretty much, you know, Michael Morrison and Tom McIntyre out, but otherwise pretty much our best team. So those kind of injury excuses kind of going out the door a little bit. And I must say, Handbags, the first half of this game, I feel sorry for the people who were neutrals and watching this and had thought, oh yeah, this will be a cracking game to watch, because it really was just dire for the first half.
It was one of those games that you just think, well, the words failed me, really. Simply because it was like you said at the start, it was billed and has been billed as a must-win game. So you're thinking they've got to go, you know, for want of a better phrase, they've got to go balls deep into the performance, and they just didn't. It was just so insipid, and I can't understand what kind of mentality a player is in when he does that in a must-win game. It was so dreadfully disappointing that first half, when, you know, ultimately Cardiff, the way they set up and played, they were there for the taking. And we did a little bit better in the second half. There was a lot more intensity and a lot more desire, it seemed. But as the game wore on, it just became more and more desperate. And if there's one thing that we've not been good at over the last few years, it's kitchen sink stuff. And I just felt that as the game wore on and as the gaps opened up at the back, particularly, we saw Cardiff creating chances on the break. And the penalty came as no surprise, to be honest with you. And it's just, yeah, so disappointing, really, the way it's all turned out. I can't really say much more than that, to be honest with you.
No, and that's the thing. It did pick up in the second half, and there were some nice things. And this, for me, the game, I'm not too sure the game in the whole 90 minutes summed up the season for me, but the second half summed up the problems in attack we've had all year, is that we are so brilliant around the box. In that middle third, I was talking about this last week, in the build-up, you know, Ajari and Elise and Swift when he came on, and the fullbacks, everything looks amazing. But when it gets into the box, it just dies. It's almost like defences are almost just daring us to come on then do something. And, you know, there's a couple of chances that did arise, and Yaku Meze put one over the bar by quite some distance. We did some really nice set piece routines, and we've done this all season. Our set plays have been really nice, but they didn't finish off. They didn't lead to much. And, you know, as you say, the penalty, I've written down that it wasn't a terrible error, but it did end our hopes of winning. And I want to know your reaction to the equaliser when Yaku Meze got it back to 1-1. Did you jump out your seat, or did you just kind of go, oh, well, fair enough, we were equalised?
It's a little bit of, I was happy that we'd avoided defeat, put it that way. But at the very least, a bit of hope and just, you know, sort of hope and pray that we could just do something magic, you know, get off. It surprised me that it took 30 seconds to kick off again, but, you know, maybe that was Cardiff setting up rather than us. You know, ironically, it was probably the first time that we'd actually thrown a cross into the box and avoided Aidan Flint, who was immense all game, I thought. Hashtag Swindon reject. but yeah, it was fist clenched, but expecting us to go hammer and tongs to get the ball back into play and back in, but back up their end of the pitch. But yeah, it just didn't happen in the end. And a bit of a soggy way to go out, really, of a game that was just must win.
Yeah, no, I must admit, I've spoken to someone else about this as well, and we both kind of said that our reactions for what should have been, you know, if that's the winner, we're flying out of our seats. But for the equaliser, it really was just... And the problem was it got me up for 30 seconds. For that 30 seconds, we got the ball up to their kind of like, you know, the corner of their box, I think. And then it went out for throw-in, and then it was just apparent that it was all too little too late. And I would have to say, the players looked, yeah, certainly on like the Yaku Meze's face and a couple of others, they looked gutted. And I think it's obviously, you know, a good thing that they did look that upset. But I was surprised in a way that they looked that gutted, because it didn't feel like a performance that warranted that emotion, if you know what I mean. It didn't feel like they'd played to that.
Yeah, I think you could look at it that way. But then it could be gutted because they know they've put in a poor performance, particularly in the first half. Not a poor performance, but, you know, well, the first half was. There's no two ways about it. They'll have been absolutely, Bauno was, you know, all throughout the game, was it seemed to be he was quite annoyed. But, you know, that first half, they know they haven't done enough. Clearly they haven't done enough because they've only scored one goal. You know, so it could be down to the performance as a whole. It could be down to how they felt about the fact that they needed to win it. They haven't won it. They're absolutely gutted. I mean, the one saving grace we have is that, you know, Bournemouth have got Norwich today. Hopefully Norwich win that. We're then 4 points behind Bournemouth. We still need to win two more games than them. Struggling to see where those extra two wins are going to come from, particularly given we've got four games in hand. We've got four games left, sorry. And of course, Bournemouth have, I'm trying to think now, Bournemouth have a game in hand, don't they? I haven't looked at the table today.
Yeah, so basically the permutations of it are that we obviously need to win four games. Like, there's no doubt about that. But for Barnsley, who have Coventry tomorrow, they've all played one less game than us, because, again, you know, they're playing after we're recording this. But if Barnsley, they need to win two, draw and have two defeats for us to be able to jump them with four wins. So if they get two wins and two draws, or three wins, then it's, you know, it's all over. Bournemouth, because their goal difference is so much better than ours, they need two wins and three defeats out of their next five for us to be able to jump them. That's basically how it is now.
Yeah.
And I think that
it's difficult to see where we're, who knows, you know, who knows. I mean, look what Swansea did last season, but, you know, the way that we've played over the last few weeks, can't really see it.
That's the problem, isn't it? Is that if Bournemouth had, you know, they've obviously won five in a row at the moment. If they had only won one of their last six, and if Reading had won five in a row, then we'd say, yeah, there's a chance. But those permutations sound nice, but it requires such a turnover in two teams' performance, not just us, but someone else's. And that is just where it becomes, you know, I think that we probably had like a 10% chance of playoffs going into this Cardiff game. Now it feels to me like 1 or 2%.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like watching those poker videos where they add the percentage chance of somebody winning a hand. it's highly unlikely now. The likelihood is a seventh place finish, but at the same time, you know, you can't turn around and say that this season hasn't been progress. And certainly over the last two or three seasons, you know, all right, we had that small period of form under Mark Bowen where we thought we were going places, but you know, you couldn't see it happening under. You could argue that it wouldn't have happened under Gomez. It definitely wouldn't have happened under Clement. And Yapstam after his first season, again, not a chance. So it's progress, and it's building on the trick now is to not do what we've done the last time. We've had a good period of form and a good season, and just completely flop. We have to have some way of attempting to redress the balance financially while also remaining competitive, and building on what we've done this season. Because you know, as devastating as it feels to miss out on the playoffs at the final fence. We've still done well this season, all told. And yeah, we just need to use that and build on the foundations that Pauno's put in place. And we've got to remember it's also a young squad with some experienced pros, but with Holmes and McIntyre playing significant chunks of games, Elise playing significant chunks of games, Ijari is still quite young, quite inexperienced. This season will stand those players in good stead, and enable them to have experienced the pressure of a promotion battle, and they'll know hopefully what they need to do next season to push on from where they are now. So it's not all doom and gloom from where I'm sat, although it is disappointing. But of course, a lot of it rides on what we do in the summer. Both financially and with players potentially leaving and coming in.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of players out of contract, which is probably my main area of concern at the moment. If we're unable to get Morrison, McIntyre, just two of the players out of contract, obviously Richards is going to go. If we're unable to get those players kept, then that would start ringing the alarm bells for me. But I know what you mean about the doom and gloom. I think it's tough because we're sat here now with the first realistic sense we're not going to make the playoffs this season. And for me, you know, funny enough, I was talking to my mum about this, and her watching of Reading Football Club certainly isn't like as fervent as mine, but she was saying you weren't going to go up anyway. And I said, well, it's not going up that upset me. It's not getting into the playoffs. And in terms of planning for next season, nothing has really changed because I didn't think we're going to win the playoffs, although I'd obviously like to. But for me, it's the being in the playoffs is that it's an achievement in and of itself, isn't it? It's being involved in the big games, all the build up and all the, you know, the hope and the glory of winning a playoff game or scoring a playoff goal. I think that's the thing that I'm kind of missing or feeling like I'm missing out on. And that's, for next season, doesn't really make any difference because players and finances don't change too much if you get in the playoffs and lose. But it's just kind of that sense of achievement, I think.
Yeah, quite. You know, whether you go up or not, you're right. As a footballer and as a football fan, you live for those big games and those big days. And yeah, it would have been nice to have been involved, but not this season. There's always next.
There is always next season. I think that might be the final line I give on the season review in a few weeks' time. Hopefully not, though. There is still a chance. So let's end the recap on a good note. Well, actually, that was the first time that a Mick McCarthy team has avoided defeat at Reading since March 2004. So Mick mm-hmm. McCarthy's ended six defeats in a row against us, which I didn't realise was going into the game quite on the balance. But it actually is, funny enough, the first time that Reading have gone five unbeaten in a row at home since March 2019. So apparently we're on a bit of a good run at home. A lot, you know, three wins and two draws out of that. So actually, it's the home form has actually been all right for the last few weeks, funny enough.
That's one thing that I think we really need to redress next season is the home form. yeah, all right, we've won plenty, but we've also lost a lot of games that we shouldn't have lost. And yeah, that it's, again, it's been frustrating to see. You know, you look at the days that we had under pretty, you know, mainly Steve Coppell and Brian McDermott. One of the key facets of a successful team, or their successful teams, was the home form. We didn't lose many at home. And, you know, we've lost, I think, 7 or 8 at home this season. And that's, again, that's really quite frustrating.
Yeah, we've lost 7 at home this year in the Championship. No team inside the top 16 has lost that many, is the big stat out of that one. So, yeah, that you're absolutely right. That needs addressing. Well, let's hear from Veljko Paunović now, and then we'll go into the mailbag and hear what you've been saying, asking questions of ourselves.
Well, I think we will have to delay one more game until we get back to the top 6. We are, as we showed and we proved again, once again, that we never give up. So we have to fight and keep pounding the rock. When I stand on the sideline and when I look at the team, I see a fantastic, fantastic team who plays a great football, creates a lot of opportunity, who never stops, and who is committed 100%. Everyone gives his best, and that's a requirement. That's a requirement since the beginning. We were unlucky in a couple of situations where we didn't convert the opportunities. I think we were solid and consistent throughout the whole match. Unfortunately, one situation changed the game, the penalty, but we came back. We came back, and you can't ask more of this group. They're really, really giving their best. And yes, we are all disappointed, but for what is worth, 1 point is 1 point. We'll see. As I said, we will have to probably delay our for one more game, delay our return.
Keep up to date with all things Reading FC. Follow the Tilehurst End on Facebook and Twitter.
So Laurie Royal starts us off this week saying he's completely confused by the team's performances. Should we be shouting from the rooftops, watch out for us next season, or should I start hiding behind the sofa? Still got to love our club and the roller coaster emotions. That is actually, you know, Handbags, one of the things I've always said about being a Reading fan, probably in the last few years has dropped off a little bit, that the amount of seasons that certainly I've watched where we've been in absolutely no fight whatsoever, I could count on one hand. And that's still the, you know, with this season, that's probably still the case.
Mm-hmm. So keep hiding behind the sofa, don't move.
Definitely. Milo saying, if we don't make the playoffs, which is looking highly likely, where does the club go from here? Seventh is a big improvement, but given the financial situation, we need to think about the long-term future of the club. Can't spend to improve, and we will have to sell players. I think that, you know, this is obviously a bigger conversation that we'll have at the end of the season. And Alistair says, basically saying, what would you say we have to improve for next season? I think that basically Reading have to learn to sell players, I think, is such an important thing. We haven't been able to sell players and turn a profit for years now. You're going back to players that Alex McCarthy left on the cheap, basically, and they were assets that didn't go well. And it's perfectly plausible that we can sell. Felice leaves in the summer, as is probably the most likely. Maybe one other, maybe someone comes in for Raphael or something like that. It's not the end of the world. And with the financial situation, it's more than Reading, a team, if they're managed properly, more than capable of turning that around into a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also on the other side of the page, you've got to look at what the players are thinking as well. You know, you look at someone, a player that's the forefront of my mind is Liam Moore, who's been the subject of big money bids, I think from Brighton in the past, and maybe a couple of others. He's been at this club for 5 years and has been in the playoffs once. He's got to be looking to progress his career. So yes, he's also on a big money contract, or presumably, shall we say, he's on a big money contract. He was one of those guys that was given a multi-year deal in the Gourlay days. So as I say, presumably he's on good money, but will also command a sizable fee. And like you say, we have to learn when to keep players and when to sell players. And one of the things, like you say, we haven't done is sold players particularly well. And it's so, so frustrating losing players like Danny Loader and Omar Richards for nothing. you know. And again, I was thinking about this earlier because they're academy products. The primary point of the academy is to produce players that are going to be first team ready. But secondary to that, it's to also look at the business side of the club and to produce players that have a good sell-on value, even if they're not quite up to the standard or if they're excessively good, like someone like Gylfi Sigurdsson. The club needs to realise that value. Both the business side and the playing side, really, over the last 2 years, hasn't been run particularly well. And it's something that I've mentioned before, and I'm sure many others have mentioned before as well, is the structure and the long-term planning of the club. Is there doesn't seem to be any. And it's, again, it's another frustration that, you know, we're in this financial pickle. All right, we've got mega rich owners with real cash to hand, but they can't sell it because of the profit and sustainability issues. And it's frustrating that they don't seem to realize that those rules are in place for a reason. You can't just throw money at it arbitrarily, but also you've got to realize value in players both financially and on the pitch. And we don't do that very well.
No, we don't. And I think one of the things that I remember when we had Leo Alito on the show earlier in the season, I asked him what went wrong from the first season of like 06-07 in the Premier League to the second. And he said that we didn't sell the players that wanted to leave and therefore they didn't play as well. And it's absolutely right that if you go back in time and you sell Leo Alito in that first summer of after 1 year in the Premier League, you get £4 million and you lose a player that doesn't want to be there effectively, or whether that's Leo or anyone else. But that helps the dressing room to do that. You bring in new faces. We've probably seen, because we're fans of the club for a long time, we've seen Reading teams sell Gylfi Sigurdsson and get better. I think that's the galling thing for us, is that we know it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's a common theme from, if you listen to a number of players from that era, I think I've heard Glenn Little say it. I've heard James Harper say it. And that's, as you say, it's a common theme. And, you know, like you say, it can be done. I just wish somebody could hypothetically bash the Dyes heads against the wall to say, look, come on, just think about this better, please.
But let it go. That's the saying, isn't it? Let it go. Moving on then, Matthew saying, substitutions. We made three of them at the same time in the 91st minute. Why do we do that? Paunovic's substitutions, I think, are a really interesting little facet of this season, because as much as we like Paunovic, he's done amazing things for the club, but his substitutions at times have really been baffling. You look at the substitutions from yesterday, bought Puskas on in the 58th minute because Zhao was injured, wait until the 77th minute to bring John Swift on. John Swift not entirely fit, but I doubt they said, oh, he's only got 13 minutes in him. That'd be a bit weird. And then, after the goal, he bought Eluko, Baldock and Tetek on for the fullbacks, and also Elise. Baldock actually set up the goal, which I'm sure he probably let Paunovic know as he walked back in afterwards. And this is the thing, isn't it, that the squad depth has been a big problem all season, but I still don't think that Paunovic has given those players enough of a chance, or whether it's the young players or players like Eluko and Baldock. I still feel that they're worth bringing on in the 70th minute rather than the 90th minute.
Yeah, quite. You know, you need to give players time to actually bed into a game as well. And it was, it was particularly the triple sub. It was reactive, and I'm not overly sure that we've been proactive with our substitutions at times, and something does need to change. And it's a frustrating point. As I say, yesterday's, like you say, Swifty coming on with just 13 minutes to go, when you know he can pull strings. All he needed to do was sit in the park, pick up the ball, and it's what he did really well for that 15 minute period that he was on. So, I can't really say anything more but to agree, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But maybe it's something that we need to get used to if Paolo's going to be here for a while.
He's always seemed to me like someone who's very aware or very, very confident in his abilities. I don't know if that goes towards stubbornness, as it kind of felt like with Yapstan, but it seems to me like he's not, yes, he is a kind of youngish manager, but maybe setting his ways is the wrong way of phrasing it. But do you know what I mean? He doesn't seem like someone who's going to turn up next summer and be like, guys, I was wrong the entire time. Here's a completely new way of doing things. I think he's an evolution sort of rather than revolution kind of manager.
No, exactly. And no doubt he'll have learned a lot from this season. But yeah, maybe, you know, the substitutions, you know, I'm trying to portray this in a way that isn't overly critical. I wish that he would be, I'm going to use it again, the word proactive, more proactive with his substitutions when we're struggling to break a game down, or even sometimes see a game out, because we've not necessarily been great at seeing too many games out, you know, comfortably this season. There's always been, maybe it's just the Reading fan in me, but it just seemed to be, you know, when just this constant discomfort when we're sort of just winning a game by one goal and perhaps need that slightly more defensive rigidity, and it hasn't always happened. I don't know whether that's just me or whether even that's a fair comment or not. But
no, sometimes there have been consolation goals that have been unnecessary. But I think I know what you mean. It's hard to know whether that is just us or whether that is football in general. And I suppose if anyone wants to trawl through those stats, they can please report back to me. But Kev O'Brien saying, do you think we've missed a golden opportunity? Can only see the team/squad being weaker next season due to financial issues. So this may have been our once in a decade chance of getting promoted. Hope I'm wrong. Well, funny enough, I suppose we've been promoted once in the last decade and had another playoff final, so maybe that's not quite as long as we need to wait for the next chance, hopefully. But I would say that in terms of golden opportunity for next season, you look at the Championship, the finances of the Championship, it's not just us. Everyone is going to be wrecked for next season for finances. If anyone wants to go and spend £10 million on a player from the Championship next season, then, you know, I don't know where they're finding that money, to be honest. So that kind of makes me feel, with Norwich and Watford going up, you know, let's face it, they would have been Championship promotion contenders next season had they stayed down. The teams that are going to be coming down from the Premier League, unless it's Newcastle, there's going to be three teams that are not substantially big football clubs there that are going to automatically demand to be re-promoted, like a Newcastle, or, you know, when Villa have come down, that sort of team has. Another team that's probably going to go up out of the Championship has been a serious promotion contender or relegated Premier League club as well, unless it's Barnsley. So really, the quality of the Championship next season, I don't think we have to assume it's going to be staggeringly high. And if that's the case, then Reading are always going to have a chance.
No, absolutely right. I do question whether or not, you know, West Brom, who are almost likely going to come down, if they keep hold of Sam Allardyce, obviously they'll be towards the top end. Sheffield United are in a little bit of turmoil at the moment. I think I read today that their chairman has stood down. Whoever else comes down, be it, you know, if it's Fulham, they'll be towards the top end of the season, top end of the table at the end of the season, no doubt. Whoever it is, I can't see too much happening with the teams coming up. You know, if it be Hull, then you're thinking mid-table. Peterborough, Portsmouth, you know, one of the teams might be riding the crest of a wave, but Peterborough, I can't see doing too much. Like I say, hopefully, it depends on who goes, I suppose, for us. If you're looking at someone like John Swift going for big money, then who is there to replace him? You've then got to keep Ejaria and perhaps Michael Elise for another season. If Elise goes, then you've got to keep John Swift. Liam Moore, if he goes, or if Michael Morrison goes, you've got to replace them. McIntyre and Tom Holmes will absolutely need that experienced head alongside them. But for me, at the same time, those two have proven that they can play at this level. The question is, do they have the consistency to play at this level, at championship level at the very least? They have the quality to, but who knows? Time will tell. But in terms of players leaving, again, like I say, it all depends on who goes and who we replace them with, because I don't think, like I say, we're going to be going out and spending £10 million on a player, because we simply can't. We haven't got the resources to do that.
No, and that links into the final question then from Sean Burgess saying, give me your likely starting 11 for the first game of next season. And I think really this depends on how ambitious you think we can be in terms of bringing in new players, because if Morrison goes, which I think is relatively likely given his contract is up, I think it just means that it's Moore and McIntyre. And then you've got Yeardom, Raphael. I don't see any particular reason to say that he'll definitely leave. Left back, you would have to say that it will be a left back. If that's Ethan Bristow or Imari Samuels from the academy, I kind of doubt, because they've not been anywhere near the first team and since like the first week of the season. So I don't think they'll be automatically promoted. The centre mids, can't see much changing with Winnemotto or Laurent. Attacking mid, this is where it gets difficult, because I think that Mate is a serious contender to go. Elise obviously is. Ejario, I don't think is. Swift is, you know, it depends. I don't think anything's going to change in terms of Zhao, so I think he'll be our number one striker next season, but that it's that attacking midfield three behind him, I think, is going to be the change. And I think that's quite hard to predict.
Answering the question directly, it is impossible, simply because you just don't know what's going to happen in the summer. So I can't tell you who's going to be in goal. Can't tell you who's going to be playing central defence. It all depends on what happens financially with the club in the summer and who we bring in and who leaves. Can't answer it.
Well, that's a very diplomatic answer. I appreciate your honesty. Well, we might need some more honesty as we go into news bites then. And let's have a little bit of a chat about those financial figures that came out in the week.
Stay tuned for all the latest from around the Medeski Stadium and the Championship with News Bites.
Before we get into this, I will just quickly point out this is going to be a pretty shortish chat, and that there's going to be a longer discussion on this that's already on the website, actually already on the podcast, with Ollie and Kira Maguire from the Price of Football Twitter account, which is a very good Twitter account that's gone through the figures and everything. So for a much more in-depth look, jump onto that podcast after you've listened to this. But for us handbags, let's have a little bit of a chat about the situation of the club. 211% of revenue was spent on wages, so that's a lot. It's down actually on the year before, but is a lot. And really, you know, the sum up point of the finances is that Reading are in a particularly bad position. They are not on the verge of bankruptcy, we don't think. That it doesn't feel like they're on the verge of a points deduction, although that could be because of the profit and sustainability rules being flicked around. We don't exactly know what's going on with that. But ultimately, it's just that Reading are overspending at the moment, not bringing enough money in, and that until we either sell a player for £40 million or get promoted, that is going to continue to be the case.
Yeah, you could have just ended the discussion at 211%, to be honest with you. That is not a healthy position to be in. And of course, the key thing to remember is that it only just begins to touch on the issues that we've had with the pandemic. So we can expect the figures next year to be significantly worse, I think. I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps you can enlighten us on what the FA have said and the EFL have said with regards to financial fair play next year. I think I heard somewhere that they said that it had been scrapped for the season. Sorry, this current season. Although I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, long and short of it is, it's not very healthy. And football clubs, and it's like you said earlier, it's not just us. Football clubs can't keep relying on benevolent owners in the form of loans, and changing those loans or converting those loans into share capital, which is, you know, pretty much what happens these days. you know, football clubs, surely football clubs have got to start looking and seeing that they need to stand on their own two feet instead of being propped up by benevolent owners. It's not a good position to be in. And something needs to happen. And as we said earlier, this particular football club, Reading Football Club, has not been good with selling players and realising financial value, business value, over the last few years. And something needs to change. That needs to change in particular. If we got a particularly lucrative asset that other that higher level clubs want, we need to maximise the value for them. Bring back Nicky Hammond.
Well, I think he's about. I think he's on his way out of Celtic actually at the moment. So maybe that is a possibility. But the thing is, as well, when it comes, as you say, there, it's trickle down economics is basically what Reading needs to take advantage of. And I saw a piece in the New York Times earlier saying that, for example, with the Erling Haaland deal, football needs a player, a club to pay £150 million for him, because then it unleashes all of this capital that can sink down to the rest of the club. So maybe Reading needs something like that to sort of bandwagon off of. But yeah, I think that it, for me, so long as, you know, money is, how Dai Young wants to spend his money is how Dai Young wants to spend his money, whether Reading make a loss of 10 million and he covers it or 40 million and he covers it, so long as he covers it, then that is kind of it. And I think there was a debt to owners of about £87 million in there, but I think that actually got reduced by about 15 because he converted it to shares, which is effectively just wipes it out. But you can't rely on that forever. So really, I think that Reading needs to get promoted or to have a serious tightening of their belt that begins, you know, it has to begin this summer, really, because it's obviously not begun last summer. And it's not going to, as you say,
this is where I think something needs to change, because clearly, I mean, what often gets lost in the ether is the reason why FFP was brought in the first place, for clubs to remain profitable and sustainable. I'm quite not entirely sure how you can suggest over a 3-year period that £37 million losses are profitable and sustainable, which are the rules at the moment. But if a club does have a benevolent owner, then something needs to be written into the rules to say, yes, you can spend your money, perhaps on a one-off cost, like a transfer fee. But the ongoing liabilities, the club needs to be able to demonstrate that it can afford those. So you can't saddle a club with 15 million pound signings and the wages that go with that. If a manager wants to spend 150 million pound on those 10 players on their transfer fees, fine. But the club has to be able to show that it can afford the wages, which are obviously the ongoing liabilities, and any other liabilities that are a part of a footballer's ongoing costs. And I think that's where football should really be able to go, is that club owners can spend their money on a football club, but the club also needs to demonstrate that it can remain in business effectively, because the club is so often said, the club is a heart of the community. The club is about its fans, and if you lose that club, what happens?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I also think I have a feeling there might be something in FFP. This might be UEFA FFP, where there's something about like infrastructure costs don't count towards it. And I don't know whether the Bearwood training ground counted towards it.
Right. They don't count towards FFP. Anything to do with, like, say, infrastructure or academy costs, anything like that, they don't count towards it. But yeah, player salary, club salary costs and things like that, they do.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
A whole other raft of things.
And that's the thing with your transfer fee point. It kind of, for me, ties into the idea that does it count towards FFP, or should it count towards these FFP rules if it is a gift from the owner? If it is £50 million of cash with no strings attached lands in Reading's bank account, is that the same thing as £50 million of cash lands in Reading's bank account that has to be repaid to the owner? Because that's a completely different kettle of fish, because a loan is a lot, you know, everyone knows the difference between a loan and a payment. So is the payment, should it be villainized in the same way that a loan should be villainized? you know, that's just a question for it that I don't think
it was an arbitrary throwaway, not throwaway, but as an arbitrary point, an idea that's been floating around my head for a little while, but I get exactly where you're coming from. And of course, the intricacies, we all know what a balance sheet looks like. And the underlying information is a complicated beast. And, you know, it's not going to be an easy thing to solve. But there needs to be something. Something needs to change.
Yeah. Well, let's to round off news by saying, let's catch up with the other Reading Football Club teams this weekend. The women's team are in action on Sunday at 2 o'clock against Spurs in the FA Cup. The under-23s lost 2-0 to Burnley yesterday. They've got Sunderland next up in just over a week. And the under-18s, they lost 4-1 to West Ham last weekend, and it was a 0-0 draw with Brighton earlier today on Saturday. So let's get into big match preview then. And I'm trying to G myself up, but it's Luton away, and let's talk about now.
Be loud and be proud and back the boys and make some noise. Come on, you Rs!
Shout out to this week's podcast sponsor, ZCZ Films, showing that age is no barrier to being a hooly hoop.
Yeah, this is not the game that we wanted to be talking about, because this really is another sense of, rather than carrying on our impressive rise back into the playoffs, this really is, if this is the last chance saloon, then it really is the last chance saloon. Luton away, yeah. 7:45, Wednesday, April 21st. It's just another one of those games. There is no great take. There is no great analysis. Just Reading have to win this.
Reading, yeah, exactly. Of course, it all rides, as you said earlier, we're recording this before the Bournemouth and Barnsley games. But yeah, irrespective of that, yeah, it is literally just go out and win. That's all we can do. So if we don't, then... And you know, let's not forget that Luton, they're no mugs, Luton. But you've got to be looking. If you're going to have any prospect of going out and getting into the playoffs, then yeah, we have to go and win all four games. It's as simple as that.
The thing is, with this game, do you think there is any chance, given that Paunovic kind of seems to suggest that we needed to win the Cardiff game, we didn't. Therefore, in his mind, in theory, quote unquote, it's over. Because it's over, will he, do you think, have any possibility of going out with a completely different team, throwing out a few kids, getting rid of, you know, the loan players that are kind of irrelevant now? Do you think there's any chance that he'll kind of make any drastic changes?
I don't think we'll see drastic changes. But it was interesting that he did bring Cetek on for the last 3 or 4 minutes last night. So we might see him dropped into midfield or certainly given more game time from the bench. But no, I don't think we'll see drastic changes at all. And you know, we don't have a huge amount to play with, certainly in defence. And you know, you might bring it. I can't see him changing the goalkeeper. Midfield, I mean, that midfield double pivot of Laurent and Rinnemhotta, that can't really change, because that's everything that our foundation is based on. So the only thing that you can really see happening is Puskas coming in for Zhao. So that's what I think will happen.
Well, Zhao supposedly, it looked like he dislocated his shoulder on Friday night. So that would, if he's ruled out for the rest of the season, then it wouldn't take very much really in the last couple of weeks of it left. I think, I don't think he's going to change very much. You said about the goalkeeper. I think Raphael played his, they said on the TV, they played his 87th consecutive championship game against Cardiff. So that's not going to change. Yep. Really, in terms of predictions then, we all went wins against Cardiff, as I'm sure everyone did, but it didn't happen. So Westy's still 2 points clear with myself and Handbags in the prediction league. I'm going to start off by saying we are going to lose this game 1-0, because I've been too ambitious with my predictions recently, and it's probably explained why I've dropped off the top. So what are you saying for this one then, Handbags?
Last chance saloon. I think actually we will go out and win it, but it will be a fruitless win. I'm going to go 2-1.
1-2 for Handbags then. So yeah, this is just another game that Reading have to win, and it certainly is that feeling at the moment. Reading have Swansea on Sunday as well, which we will be back after. That's a noon kickoff against Swansea on April 25th. Not too much to say about that now, other than we need to win it. You'll be surprised to hear. So we will be back next time after that Swansea game. Thank you very much for listening to episode 261 of the TRLSN podcast. Handbags, always a pleasure to have you on, mate.
No problem. Thank you very much indeed.
And we shall be back in a week's time when Reading season, well, at the very least, we will probably know where we stand. Until then, come on, you arse.
You smile, funny how the crumbs